Here he chanced to look across the fields to the house so recently struck by untimely death, and his throat began to close up, and his eyes to fill with tears. He lost track of what he was saying, and almost began to blubber, so great was his anguish over the fate of Matty Quimper. And he became so incoherent that the wiser men among the grooms winked at one another. The old man's drunk again. He wasn't, not then. But when he returned to sit with Matty on the porch, endeavoring to console her, he did start to drink heavily, so that when Reverend Harrison returned, eligible to rejoin them now that the Romish ceremony was ended, Cluny was ready to embrace him as a brother. "Harrison, we must both give consolation to this good Christian woman." As evening approached, he became quite drunk, and at one point he said to Harrison, as if he had never seen him before, "Me name's Father Cluny, of Ballycluny on Cluny Bay in County Clare." But when the stiff Protestant ignored him, he realized his foolishness and said hastily, "You're Reverend Harrison. You and I must look after Yancey now. He'll need a father." And he began calling, "Yancey? Yancey?" When there was no answer, he looked hazily at Harrison, lay down upon the porch, and passed easily into a deep sleep that would last through the night. "God blessed me in one thing," Matty said as darkness fell. "He allowed me to know 4 good men. You, that one down there, Stephen Austin, and Jubal. Many women never know none." Harrison said boldly, "You must take a new husband, Matty. You'll need help to run the inn and the ferry." At this moment, on the far shore, a late traveler hallooed, "Can you fetch me? I have no food, no blankets." She left the porch, went down to the Brazos, and pulled sturdily across the narrow river to where the pilgrim waited. When the boat was loaded, she shoved off, and in the moonlight brought him to the warmth of her inn. Task Force. We experienced the first open break in our task force when we met in October 1983 to plan our impending meeting in Tyler, where the topic was to be Religion in Texas. We found it difficult to agree upon an appropriate speaker, for although none of us had strong convictions regarding specific theologies, and certainly we did not want to intrude on clerical matters, we were aware that sectarianism had played a recurrent role in forming Texas attitudes. But we did not know whom to invite, and because there were differences among us, we postponed our meeting till November. The blow-up involved not religion, but the successful American invasion of the little Caribbean island of Grenada. Rusk and Quimper, as gung-ho Texans, applauded the action. "We should have done it years ago," Quimper said. "And since we have a running start, let's move on to Nicaragua and Cuba." Miss Cobb, descendant of Democratic senators, voiced a much different view. President Reagan, having seen how much the invasion of the Falklands helped Maggie Thatcher win re-election in Great Britain, is pulling the same trick in the United States. "And succeeding," Rusk snapped, and she agreed. "He is, brilliantly. If the election were held tomorrow, he'd win in a landslide. America does love its successful little wars, but tires quickly of its big, unsuccessful ones." "That's communist talk," Rusk said, and Quimper agreed. "If you got strength, you got to show it, or they don't believe you have it." Dr. Garza tried to slow down the animosities by advancing a more sober theory. "America must proceed very carefully. In every Latin country there's latent memory of Marines invading at will. If we run rampant in the Caribbean, we'll engender a profound revulsion. We must go slow." Rusk spoke like a letter to the editor of a Texas newspaper when he said, "We shouldn't give a damn what they think about us. We should discipline Cuba right now. And if Nicaragua is in the Cuban camp, we should knock it out, too. We've had enough liberal shilly-shallying." "Do you want to nuke Nicaragua?" Miss Cobb asked. And Rusk replied, "If necessary." To which Garza asked, and risk Armageddon? With the battle lines thus firmly drawn, Rusk and Quimper versus Cobb and Garza, the members looked to me, and I could not escape revealing my opinion. I side with the popular opinion in Texas. I believe the invasion of Grenada was justified. I think it forestalled Cuban action, and I'm sure it's re-elected Ronald Reagan. Miss Cobb was disappointed with me. Do you know how big Grenada is? Smaller than the tiniest Texas county. Does America gain glory by subduing such a target? Wake Island was lots smaller, I retorted quickly, and we gained a lot of glory there. You excise a cancer when it's small, or you lose a life. Garza groaned at this forced analogy, and there would have been further debate had not our staff insisted that we reach a decision concerning the program for our meeting on religion. So we turned from one heated battleground to another. Dr. Garza suggested a professor from a Catholic college in New Mexico, believing that this would provide continuity from the very first days to the present. But Quimper objected vigorously, and with reason. I thought we settled that at our El Paso meeting. No more Catholics. Texas is a Protestant state, whose moral attitudes were determined by Protestants. You're right, Garza conceded with no rancor. I was just trying to advance the interests of my boys. Don't blame you, Rusk interrupted. But now I want to advance the interests of my boys. My grandparents were Quaker and Baptist. Very few Quakers in Texas, thank God, because the two religions... What two religions? Miss Cobb interrupted. Quaker and Texas. They don't mix. I recommend we invite a Baptist minister. Now wait, Rance, Quimper protested. Texas was settled primarily by Methodists, and I'd like to hear an honest Methodist interpretation. After the two men wrestled over this without reaching a solution, Rusk asked, Lorena, what are you? And Miss Cobb said, What the Southern gentlefolk always were, Episcopalian, but in Texas we've carried little weight. The four now turned to me, and Quimper asked, Barlow, you've never said what religion you are. And I replied, Home Lutheran. And they all asked, What's that? And I explained. When I taught school in a small town in the Panhandle, the board was very nosy about their teacher's religion, and my crusty old principal told me, Tell 'em you're a Home Lutheran, very devout, but you conduct your services in the privacy of your home. I did, and got away with it. Rusk took me up on this. Since we can't agree among the four of us, and since Texas has almost no home Lutherans, whom would you suggest? After making a chain of phone calls, I came up with an almost perfect solution, and at our November meeting in Tyler, where a few late roses were still in bloom, I presented him, a tall, thin man in his 50s, wise of countenance and witty of eye. He looked like a clergyman, even in mufti, for you could see that he had been trained to speak in a certain way and to enforce his words with effective gestures. What was equally important to our purpose, for he was to outline a weighty and sometimes contentious topic, he had a sense of humor. I allowed him to introduce himself, which he did gracefully. I'm an ordained minister, professor in the Bible department, Abilene Christian College. The Roman numerals after my name indicate how many generations of my family have served in Texas. I'm Joel Job Harrison VI. He asked our forbearance as he explained the religious history of his family, for he said that if we understood it, we would better appreciate the religious tempests which had from time to time swept Texas. The first Joel Job Harrison came to the Trinity River in the early 1820s, as a secret Methodist circuit rider sent down to infiltrate Catholic Mexico. Devout religionists in Kentucky gave him explicit instructions. Combat the Papists. He seems to have been a violent defender of his faith, conducting secret meetings up and down the rivers. And, as you know, he helped ignite the sparks that led to open warfare against Santa Ana. Faithful to his own preachings, He led one of the critical charges at San Jacinto, then roamed across Texas during the Republic, building the Methodist churches that had not been permitted under Mexican rule. He was not a likable man, if we can believe the diarists of that time, for some of them dismiss him with contempt. But he was a warrior, and Texas Methodism owes him many debts. Joel Job III was one of those titanic clergymen who sweep across Texas from time to time. Reading his Bible one day, he made the discovery that projected him into endless battles against the Baptists, the Presbyterians, and all other infidel sects. It was a curious thing. He came to believe that whereas John the Baptist had clearly baptized Jesus Christ in the Jordan River by a process which could only be called total immersion, so that there was biblical justification for the rite as performed by the Baptists, there was no holy obligation to keep on using it, and he began to preach strong and beautifully reasoned sermons against the Baptists, and especially against the sect called the Campbellites. Well, the Baptists weren't going to sit by and allow this to happen, so they threw three of their ablest men against him, one after another, and great public debates were held across North Texas. A tent would be raised or a building rented, and J.J. Harrison III, in heavy black suit and red string tie, his white hair flowing, would take on the current Baptist champion. For five successive days, they would debate each afternoon, 2 o'clock to five, and thousands would lean forward to catch their words. Joel Job III had a majestic voice, a gift for scorn, and an unrelenting sense for the theological jugular. Both he and his adversary believed they were fighting for immortal souls. Their debates became famous, and the men were fondly referred to as our peerless ecclesiastical pugilists. You can find in old bookstores printed versions of their battles, the Harrison-Brand debates, the Harrison-Cleaver debates, or the famous Harrison-Harper debates. Harrison's name always came first because he was the more famous arguer and the one who attracted the crowds. But he confessed in a letter to a fellow Methodist clergyman, I always felt that I had defended our cause ably, but I rarely felt that I had won, because those Baptists threw against me some of the most tenacious debaters I had ever faced. They were men of learning, devotion, and infinite skill in the nasty tricks of argument. Lanning Harper was the ablest man I ever battled, and in our four series in 1890 to 1893, I fear that he bested me on several occasions. Looking back on those days, I think of him as a Lion of Judah, and I would not care to face him again tomorrow. He had a wry sense of humor, and several times after we had lambasted each other on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, we would unite on Thursday against the Presbyterians, whose doctrine of fatal predestination we simply could not comprehend. And it was Harper who introduced the doggerel which summarized our contempt. I can still hear the audiences laughing when he recited, We are the sweet selected few. The rest of you be damned. There's room enough in hell for you. We don't want heaven crammed. He was smiling as he finished these lines, but abruptly he turned grave. For now he must share with us a somber incident in his family history, one which produced both anguish and theological glory. Throughout the lives of 1, 2, and 3, my ancestors were aware, vaguely at times, of a powerful primitive force gathering strength on the horizon. It centered upon a man named Alexander Campbell, born a good Presbyterian in County Antrim, Ireland, in 1788. The birth of a child forced Campbell to decide what he thought about baptism, and the more he studied the Bible, the more convinced he became that Presbyterians were out of step with the New Testament when they merely sprinkled a baby and called that baptism, while the Baptists were correct to insist upon total immersion. To the scandal of his time, he left the Presbyterians with loud renunciation and became a Baptist. He didn't stay long, for although he granted that his new church was right on baptism, he found it wrong on almost everything else. He especially rejected the vainglorious church structure it had erected to govern what in Christ's day had been free individual churches, each master of its own destiny. Fulminating against synods, regional associations, and presbyteries, he was extremely harsh on professional clergymen who set themselves above ordinary laymen. Protestant priests, he called them scornfully. In every aspect of religious life, Campbell yearned to get back to the simplicity of that first glorious century of the Christian era. His theories swept across the American South like a firestorm, with converts announcing themselves as Campbellites. And from what established churches did these converts come? From the Methodists and Baptists. The infection grew malignant, with entire congregations quitting the known churches and moving en masse into Campbell's arms. Well, Joel Job III, as a faithful Methodist, realized that something must be done to staunch this hemorrhaging. So, during the great debates, after lambasting the Presbyterians on Thursday, he and his Baptist adversary would unite on Friday to excoriate the Campbellites, who did not like that pejorative name. They called themselves the Churches in Christ, for they believed that they preserved the simplicity that Jesus would have approved. I have several pamphlets which preserve Joel Job's attacks on the Campbellites, and they are rather sulphurous. Again and again he warned, "Do not lure good Methodists into your infamous trap." Our speaker paused to reflect upon these tempestuous days, then squared his shoulders and revealed an astonishing fact. In 1894, the religious world of Texas was shocked when this tower of Methodism, this peerless debater, went into seclusion, studied his Bible, and emerged with a startling revelation. "I can no longer support the Methodist Church as it now exists. I am departing from it to become a minister in the Church of Christ." This was trebly scandalous, since he was in effect joining forces with his ancient foes, the Campbellites, against whom he had so furiously inveighed. Harrison shook his head, even now startled by his ancestors' apostasy, but then he smiled like a little boy. "I warned you that we took religion seriously, and as you might expect, in his new reincarnation, Joel Job III became a conservative terror. Apparently he hungered for a simpler, stabler form of worship. So before 6 months had passed, he found himself joyously in the middle of the great fight which tore his new religion apart. You may smile when I tell you what four innovations he fought against. Missionary societies and organizations, because they were not specifically designated in the Bible. Sunday school, because he could find no justification in the Bible. Rebaptism of Baptists, Methodists, and Presbyterians who wanted to join the new church. If one baptism was good enough for John and Jesus, it's good enough for Farmer Jones of Waco. And his most violent hatred, instrumental music inside the church, for he could not find it mentioned as such in the New Testament. He particularly despised organs, which he felt to be an Italian-French contamination, and therefore probably Catholic. Have you ever read an account of what happened when he learned that members of his own congregation had collected funds for the purchase of an organ? He found that they had got the money by conducting an entertainment of singing at which punch was served. The punch contained no alcohol, but when he shouted about it from his pulpit, you'd have thought it was 150-proof rum. When the organ was brought within the church, he threatened to burn the place down, and was halted only by the liberals, who threw eggs at him while newspaper reporters watched. Our speaker shivered, recalling the shock of those fevered days, but soon the inevitable smile returned. As you probably know, I am myself Church of Christ, and happy with the way my ecclesiastical life has developed. Believe me, I burn no churches. "Would you object," Rosk asked, "if I called you a modern-day Campbellite?" And he replied, "Yes, I would. My church is much bigger in concept than the doctrine of one man. Why not just call me a Christian?" He waved his hands as if to brush away the great schism of which Joel Job III had been so conspicuous a part. With his son, J.J. IV, our family got involved in Prohibition, which wrecked Texas politics. he stormed the state with his old Methodist evangelism resurgent. He gloried in hauling onto his stage mothers and children made destitute by the drunkenness of their men. And if some sad bank teller absconded with $3,000, he trumpeted the case in 40 counties, proving that alcohol had done the man in. He smashed his way into saloons, offered to wrestle peddlers of booze, and harried Texas into voting for prohibition. On the day it became national law, he cried at a great mass meeting in Dallas, "The soul of America has been saved." Now he stepped forward as a watchdog of enforcement, riding with sheriffs as they raided speakeasies and testifying in court repeatedly. Those favoring the free movement of contraband up from Mexico or down from Oklahoma said of my grandfather, "Nothing wrong with Joel Job IV that a couple of cold beers wouldn't fix." But he attained his greatest fame, and I think power, in the election of 1928, when he opposed the candidacy of Al Smith, partly because Smith was Catholic, but even more because Al favored demon rum. When Smith was nominated in Houston, my grandfather shouted from a dozen pulpits, "Darkest day in Texas history defames the sacred memory of the Alamo." And from that moment on, he toured the state relentlessly, preaching against Smith and the Democrats, who proposed to lead the nation astray. Like all Harrisons, Number 4 was a Democrat, but Al Smith was more than he could stomach, and after the votes were counted, the Republican National Committee sent him a telegram of gratitude for having moved Texas into their column. "You have done a masterful job for Texas and the entire nation." Grandfather believed this, and one of my earliest memories is watching as he took this telegram from his portfolio to let me read it. Tears streamed down his face as he said, "In 1928, we fought the good fight. But in 1932, the forces of evil struck back." He was speaking of repeal. He died believing that America was sliding to perdition because of its tolerance of drink. Quimper, a heavy drinker, interrupted, "But, Reverend Harrison, didn't you recently lead the fight against alcohol in those 3 western counties which held a referendum on saloons?" "I did, and I'm proud to say we kept those counties dry. I consider alcohol an abiding evil." "Thank you," Quimper said, bowing as if to a debating adversary. Then Harrison said, "I share these things with you to remind you that in Texas we take religion seriously. It can even be, as I shall demonstrate in a moment, a matter of life and death." He then launched into his formal paper, which I shall summarize in his words. Except during the Republic, when secularism ran rampant, religion has always been a major force in Texas life, and often the major force. No state in the Union pays greater deference to religion or supports it more vigorously. The Founding Fathers were unequivocal. Stephen F. Austin sought for his colony only devout Christians. Even a somewhat suspect hero like William Travis of Alamo fame, who dealt in slaves and deserted his family, could, in 1835, write to the leaders of his church, "We are very destitute of religious instruction in this extensive fine country. About 5 educated and talented young preachers would find employment in Texas, and no doubt would produce much good in this benighted land. Texas is composed of the shrewdest and most intelligent population of any new country on earth. Therefore, a preacher, to do good, must be respectable and talented. Remember Texas." Texas became a state partly because loyal Protestants from the North and the South refused to accept Catholicism or any established church as the state religion, and much of the animosity Anglos in the new nation of Texas felt toward their Mexican citizens along the border stemmed from the fact that those loyal Catholics adhered to customs which were morally offensive to the Puritanic Protestant majority in the northern parts of the state. Even today, you less traditionally devout members of this task force cannot comprehend how embittered we Protestants can become when we hear that churches along the border permit the drinking of alcohol and the gambling of bingo on church property. We cannot understand such profanation. The religious impulse influences Texas life at every level and in the most unexpected ways. To this day, it keeps most stores closed on Sunday. It determined that Texas would lead the nation in the fight for prohibition. It dominates school boards. It accounts for great universities like Southern Methodist, which Joel Job III helped found, and Texas Christian and Abilene Christian, which J.J. V was so instrumental in financing. In today's world, it explains why so many radio and television stations allocate much of their time to media ministers who collect more funds from Texas listeners than from any other state. Indeed, if one studied only the outward manifestations of religion, one would be justified in concluding that Texas is now and always has been the most Christian of nations. And it is understandable that many Texans, and perhaps most, believe this to be the case. We love our churches and defend them vociferously. But if one steps back dispassionately and assesses with cold eye the actual conditions in Texas, one must wonder how deep this religious conviction runs. You are more likely to be murdered in Odessa than in any other city in the nation. It and Grand Forks, North Dakota, are of comparable size, but Odessa produces 29.8 murders per thousand. Grand Forks, 1. Dallas gunmen shoot more police officers in a year than do the citizens of Philadelphia, Detroit, San Diego, Phoenix, Baltimore, St. Louis, San Francisco, and Boston combined. Such amazing figures can be explained only by some inherent Texas differential. Our state officials go regularly to jail for blatant offenses which do not occur with such frequency in states like Iowa and South Dakota. Each autumn, 3 or 4 Texas high schools watch their football teams forfeit all their games because they broke the rules knowingly. Deaths on Texas highways from drunk driving are shattering in their regularity. And one has to be amused at the famous bass fishing contest held at Lake of the Pines near Jefferson. Total prize money, $105,000. Created an open scandal because Texas sportsmen were caught fastening onto their hooks 12-pound frozen bass flown down from Minnesota, allowing them to thaw in the warm water, then reeling them in with delighted cries. "Hey, look what I caught!" When this was detected, other contestants hired scuba divers to swim to the bottom with live bass from Wisconsin to fix to their lines. Solution? Give every fisherman a lie detector test. When 60% of the winners failed, loyal Texans cried, "Understandable, they were all from Oklahoma." Historically, Texas Christians, good church members all, have been loath to face up to the moral problems of their time. Joel Job I was a stout defender of slavery, and both Harrison II and III leaped into Confederate uniform during the war between the states to serve as chaplains, for they believed that slavery was ordained by God and must be prolonged. Harrison IV, who led the fight against drink and Al Smith, also led the fight for the revival of the Ku Klux Klan, and preached 2 notable sermons explaining why it was doing God's work in Texas. At this point he coughed, rather nervously, I thought, and fumbled among his papers for a small document, whose nature I could not determine from where I sat, before continuing, "Nothing exemplifies better the complexities of the moral order in Texas than this well-edited little publication. The Blue Book for visitors, tourists, and those seeking a good time while in San Antonio, Texas, 1911 to 1912. It defines the red light district, Via Dolorosa to Matamoros, and lists the more luxurious houses of prostitution therein. Lillian Revere seems to have run an attractive place at 514 Matamoros Street. Old phone, 1357, new phone, 1888. private phone 2056. To get there, her advertisement said, you took the San Fernando streetcar, got off at South Pecos and Matamoros, and there you were. The book divides the women into three classes, 22 A's, 20 B's, 62 C's, and gives addresses and phone numbers. It also lists 33 cab drivers who can be trusted. Among the names, several attract attention. Beatrice Benedict, Class A, apparently ran three houses, but how she did this is not explained. One of the Class B girls was named El Toro, and one of the Class C's was Japanese. One of the cab drivers was John Ashton, English Jack, and on page 17 is something I rather liked, the complete baseball schedule for San Antonio's games in the Texas League. Reverend Harrison told us that he had often pondered these apparent contradictions and had decided that they did not really represent moral confusion. The Texan who guns down his neighbor does not visualize himself as committing a crime. He is merely settling an argument within the accepted Texas tradition. The Texas billionaire who has three wives, three households, and three families of children at the same time cannot conceive of himself as doing anything wrong. He is merely perpetuating the free life of the frontier, and he sees himself as being a better Texan for so doing. With no apologies, he supports his church, helping to finance its attack on immorality and loose living. Every example of social disorganization which the Northern critic might cite in an attack upon Texas can be explained away by the Texan apologist with the statement, "But that's the way we've always done it in Texas." If any item of behavior is accepted by the majority, then it becomes part of the Texas theology, serving as its own justification. The good people who published the Blue Book were satisfied that they were providing a constructive service. In no instance is this more clearly demonstrated than in the case of wetbacks along the Rio Grande. For generations, Texas planters, first in cotton, then in citrus, utilized those people under living conditions which were appalling at best and tragic at worst. Good church members who sent their sons and daughters to SMU or TCU saw nothing wrong in treating their Mexican workers worse than they did their animals. And their justification was, they're better off here than they would be back in Saltillo. In the early 1900s, the fiery Baptist minister John Franklin Norris led a noisy crusade against horse racing, gambling, and alcohol. Distressed by the perfidy of women, he launched fevered sermons against short skirts, bobbed hair, and dancing. But his fiercest ire was reserved for any professors at Baylor, the Baptist University, who veered even one inch from what he felt was the literal truth of the Bible, and he succeeded in getting several fired. Idolized by Texans as their revealed prophet, he startled some of his weak-kneed supporters in 1926 by winning an argument with a gentleman and winning it by the simple expedient of whipping out a revolver and shooting the man dead with three well-placed bullets. The jury found him innocent, on the grounds, I suppose, that he was a member of the cloth and therefore incapable of doing wrong. How tragic these Texas religious debates could become was illustrated in the case of W.C. Bran, the Voltaire of Waco, who in the 1890s published a famous muckraking journal, The Iconoclast, which delighted in castigating Baptists for their spiritual and moral deficiencies. Unable to bear his jibes, which circulated about the world, religious fanatics took stern measures. Once they thrashed him in public, then they kidnapped him. They came close to lynching him, and finally they killed him with a shot in the back, right where the suspenders crossed. And later, they desecrated his grave. The contradictions have survived into our time, for recently, Brother Lester Roloff, another powerful evangelist, ran children's homes in the Corpus Christi area, which broke every rule in the book. Yet the state excused him, on the grounds that he was a God-fearing clergyman, and therefore exempt from normal restraints. "What should we in fairness say in our report?" Miss Cobb asked. And Joel Job VI was prompt in his response. "That Texas really is a state which honors religion far more than most. Basic to everything we do is a reverence for religion, but we insist upon constructing our own theology." Chapter 5. The Trace. Of the various national groups that settled in Texas, and there were more than 20, Germans, Czechs, Poles, Vens, the one which gave the area its basic character came from Ireland. They arrived in great numbers, filtering down the famed Natchez Trace from Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. They were a resolute, courageous, self-driven, arrogant lot. Often surprisingly well-educated, the vast majority had been raised as Presbyterians, although many in recent years had become Methodists or Baptists. To appreciate their unique qualities, it will be instructive to follow one stubborn fellow as he makes his way slowly, accidentally, toward Texas. To do this, it'll be necessary to jump backward in time to the blustery winter of 1802 and to a long, beautiful glen that ran west to east at the center of Scotland. At its far end, Glen Lyon was marked by a small mountain-girt loch, from which tumbled a sparkling river that bred trout and provided water for the sturdy Highland cattle grazing along its banks. On the shore of the loch, so positioned that a man could survey the protecting mountains and also see any enemies who might be climbing the glen, stood a dwelling, low and dark, but of three rooms. Its foundation was of solid boulders. Its sides were of heavy, half-worked stone, and its thatch and turf roof was held down by a network of thick heather ropes, from whose ends dangled large rocks to offset the lifting power of the winds, which often howled down the mountains. This dwelling, Dunessan by name, was occupied by the family of a redoubtable man in his 70s, whose forebears, generations earlier, had fled into the remote fastnesses of Glen Lyon after being harried and driven from their ancestral lands. A stubborn clan, they had persistently backed the wrong side in wars and had paid the penalty. The old man was MacNab of Dunessan, patriarchal head of the local branch of the MacNabs, one of the most contentious clans in Scotland. He was a big man, veteran of a dozen Highland battles, and he looked especially formidable when clad in the crimson-green-red tartan of the MacNabs, with dirk and claymore at the ready. He wore white mutton-chop whiskers and a Highland bonnet, and seemed always ready to take up arms for some new battlefield. But recently, an old bullet wound in his left leg had begun to impede him, forcing him to stay close to his house, from which he still roared orders to his kinsmen. On this morning he was in a gentler mood, for he rested with his grandson Finlay on a wooden bench outside the door, trying to catch whatever heat the wintry sun provided. "Have you ever wondered," he asked the boy, "why we MacNabs always cling to the MacDonalds and guard against the treacherous Campbells?" "Glencoe," the lad said promptly. "But why Glencoe?" When the boy, only 10 years old, displayed an imperfect understanding of that tragic name, the old man drew him closer. "In the long run of human history, no event surpasses the villainy of the Campbells at Glencoe." And he proceeded to summarize that Highland horror, in which the Campbells, seeking to curry favor with an English king, insinuated themselves into the good graces of the rebellious MacDonalds. Appearing suddenly in the remote and gloomy fastness of Glencoe, they passed themselves off as friendly travelers. But after more than a week of feasting and singing and wooing the MacDonald lassies, the Campbells, in dead of night, fell upon their hosts and slaughtered them. "It wasn't the killing, mind you," the old man said, his hands trembling with rage as he recalled this ancient wrong. "Our glens have seen murder before. It was the perfidy. to sup with a man for 10 days in a row, and on the 11th, when your belly is filled with his bread, to slay him in the dead of night, befouling his own home.
Why didn't the MacDonalds fight back? Young Finlay asked.
Those trapped in their own homes had no chance, but those clans outside who pertain to the MacDonalds have never stopped seeking revenge. Taking his grandson's hands, he said solemnly, Laddie, wherever, whenever you meet a Campbell, expect treachery. Never forget that your father died fighting them.
The next 2 years in Glen Lyon were marked by the arrival of a tall, gawky man who intended to bring piety and learning to this embattled area. He was Ninian Gow, Master of Arts from the University of St. Andrews in eastern Scotland, and ordained as a minister in the Presbyterian Church founded by John Knox. He was deep-visaged and had large, dark hairs which grew out from his Adam's apple and moved in the air when he preached. He was incontestably a man of God and a fearless champion of decency. He loved his church and had made great sacrifices to serve it, but he loved mankind more. His two abiding convictions were that Scotland could not be truly saved until its young people, boys and girls alike, learned to read, and that it was doomed unless it combated the evils of popery. "The Campbells are Catholics, you know," he roared during his first sermon in the Glen. "The glorious Reformation which brought us the true religion, Presbyterianism in its moral grandeur, never reached the blighted glens in which the craven Campbells lurked. They remained unconverted, as they do to this day, and snared in the web of popery." At this point he halted his sermon and stared out at the small gathering of McNabs and MacDonalds, asking finally in a hushed voice, "Is it any wonder that they saw no evil in worming their way into the affections of the MacDonalds and then slaughtering them?" Silence filled the tiny kirk, broken only by Gow's deep voice crying, "Let us pray." This was an ominous invitation, for a prayer by Ninian Gow was apt to last a good 20 minutes, and on those sulphurous Sundays when he paid full attention to the papist menace, it could consume twice that time. He had not been in Glen Lyon long when he began to recognize that Finlay MacNab, grandson of the clan's patriarch, had unusual prospects, and when he consulted the local dominie, he was pleased to hear, "The lad masters his numbers quickly and learns to read more ably than others older than himself." The teacher said that Finlay had also acquired a fine, open style of lettering, and this obviously pleased him, for he said, "Clear handwriting is proof of a clear conscience." When Ninian Gow made his first report to old MacNab on the boy's progress, he broached the subject of the University of St. Andrews as a likely target for the lad's ambitions. Finlay's grandfather had never considered sending his grandson to college, but he had such a high regard for the good sense of the new minister that after he heard him out, he said he would think about it, then asked, "And where is this St. Andrews?" That simple question was all Master Gow needed. "It lies on the coast of Fife, an old city of grey stone hard by the northern sea. It is marked by ancient ruins and fine new college buildings. It's the foundation of Presbyterianism in Scotland, and it is not by accident that its once Catholic cathedral is now in ruins. God struck it down. And along its hallowed streets, set deep within the cobbled stones, stand memorials to the founders of our religion, whom the papists burned to death for refusing to abjure their new Presbyterianism." "It sounds like a holy place," said MacNab, and his wife nodded silent agreement. "It's more," the minister said, revealing a hitherto hidden side of his character. "For a small town, it has an unusual number of taverns, 23 in all, it said, where the scholars gather after their studies. And, of course, it has the gowf." "The what?" MacNab asked. "The gowf, a links of fair green stretching beside the sea.
a wee ball stuffed with feathers, 3 clubs to smash it with, and 4 happy hours in the windy sunlight.
"Surely it's not a game you're speaking of?" the Dour Highlander asked.
"Aye, the grandest game of them all. All the scholars at St. Andrews play at the Gowf, aye, more than most."
"Do you still play?" McNab asked.
"Aye, that I do. We have no links, that's true, but I have my clubs, and I brought with me 3 wee balls. And in the evening I like to hit them far and away down the meadows, making believe that I am once more at St. Andrews, studying the Bible at St. Mary's College, and playing along the links at the seaside."
On many occasions he returned to the subject of St. Andrews and the feasibility of young McNab's reporting there for schooling. But finally, the old man told him why he opposed the idea.
"I have no mind to see a grandson of mine take up the ministry."
"Oh, sir, only a few who attend St. Andrews elect the ministry. It's for everyone, the merchant, the laird, the man who sends his ships to Holland."
"But what would a grandson of mine profit from such a place if he was to come back to this glen and live as I have lived?"
"The learning, man. Think of the learning."
And he spoke with such reverence for the simple act of knowing that McNab began to consider this curious possibility, that a son of the glen could attend the university and become a better man for having done so, regardless of what occupation he followed thereafter. The practicability of such a move became so challenging to McNab that one afternoon he walked down to the kirk and asked the minister,
"Tell me one thing. What boy in a crofter's glen needs Latin?"
And Gow said softly, "The boy who is destined to leave the crofter's glen." The answer was so perceptive that after supper McNab held a quiet discussion with his wife and their clever grandson.
"Would you like to go to St. Andrews, as the minister says?" he asked the boy.
And Finlay replied, "I'm good at books, first in Euclid and Cicero."
"To what purpose?" the old warrior asked in real perplexity.
"I don't know," Finlay said honestly. "I like to play about with figures and words."
"What say you, Meharry?" McNab asked his wife.
"I have always thought he was a lad of promise."
"That means he would make a good drover."
"I would," Finlay said eagerly. "I could drove the cattle to Falkirk for the tryst this year."
"You?"
the old man asked in wonder, for he had not perceived his grandson as ready for such responsibility.
"How old are you, lad?"
12.
"At 12 I had not left the glen," the chieftain said.
"But you had fought the Campbells 3 times," his wife reminded him.
"So you would like to go to the college?" the old man asked.
"I am so minded."
As the summer progressed, McNab ruefully conceded that he would never again trudge over the far hills to Falkirk, and that it was time for his grandson to do so. "Besides, there will be older friends to help when it comes time to bargain with those clever buyers from the south." And once this big question was settled, the old man agreed that Finlay should keep some of the money from the cattle sale and proceed to the University of St. Andrews. By July, all was settled, and Ninian Gow was writing letters to a friend of his in the old gray city. "I am sending you a fine wee laddie, Finlay McNab of Glenlyon, age 13 when he arrives. Take him under your wing and tutor him for the university, which he should be ready to enter at age 14. He has completed Euclid, is knowledgeable and solaced, and is capable in all ways. Nina Gow." Postscriptum. "I am converting heathen Highlanders into good Christians at such a rate that John Knox must be smiling." The last half of July and all of August were spent in preparing Finlay for the arduous task of droving his cattle to the great market at Falkirk, nearly 80 long miles to the southeast, over steep mountain crests and down beautiful glens. The boy practiced with Rob, the deerhound collie who would do most of the work. Whistled signals would direct the dog to round up strays and keep the herd moving forward.
but at times it would seem as if the dog was directing the boy and not the other way around, so quick and intelligent was this remarkable animal. Meanwhile, the boy's grandmother had been gathering the things she must supply. The strong cheese, the beef strips dried in the sun, the oat cakes hardened on the windowsill, and particularly the great kilt in which her grandson would live for many weeks. It was not one of those townsman's kilts, little more than a pleated skirt tied at the waist. This was a Highlander's fighting droving kilt, a huge spread of patterned fabric, crimson, green, red for the McNabs, which covered the body from head to heel, with much left over to form a cape in case of storms. When his grandmother had it trimmed to her taste, she threw it on the ground, spread it out, and commanded her grandson, "Lie down." And when he placed himself prone upon it, so that it reached from his ankles to well beyond his head, she showed him how to roll about and dress himself in it, not rising to his knees until it was properly fitted, and then to a full standing position so that he could fasten the overage about his waist, to be unwound when needed. A Scots Highlander, dressed in such a kilt, carried 20 pounds of tartan, a kind of ambulatory tent, which kept him safe in all weathers. When he stood before her, wrapped in this cloak of honor, she thought, "What a handsome lad he is, with the flashing blue eyes of his clan." And his youthful eyes did have that fire, for in the 8th and 9th centuries, the Vikings of Norway had guided their longships to the fjords of western Scotland, raiding and ravishing, and many Highlanders carried the strain of those heroic days. Stalwart bodies, placid dispositions until aroused, and always scintillating eyes like those of the McNabs. "You're ready," his grandmother said. Toward the end of August, the first drovers appeared in the glen, and all stopped by the home of McNab of Dunessan to exchange greetings and information. They were from the outer islands mostly, men from Lewis and Harris and the Uists, who had shipped their cattle by boat across the Minch to the Isle of Skye, and then through the perilous open fjord which separated Skye from the mainland. Any drover from the outer isles who reached Glen Lyon with his herd intact was already a hero. These islanders were an uncouth band, speaking Gaelic, with just enough words of mainland Scots to enable them to function. Short, dark, somber in mien, and rude in manner, they terrified the normal mainland Scot, who said, "Two Skye men passing through a glen are worse than 3 floods or 4 thunderstorms, and a Uist man is worse." They stole cattle, robbed cottages, terrorized daughters, and left scars wherever they touched. They were the scourge of Scotland, the island drovers who knew not God. But in Glen Lyon they met their match, for the various McNabs, long inured to battle, were themselves some of the most polished cattle thieves in Scottish history. It was said of the present McNab, that sanctimonious church-going scoundrel, that he loves animals so tenderly that he feels it his responsibility to take into his care any strays that wander his way. Many a Skye drover entering Glen Lyon with 121 animals departed with only 118, and it was frequently remarked at how good a cowman McNab was, since his own herd increased so steadily. "A good dog and a quick eye make the drover," McNab often said. And he had both, plus an ingredient he did not specify. He was fearless in the prosecution of his trade, and took great risks in augmenting his herd. On the cattle trails, he had lived with 2 dirks hidden in the folds of his kilt, and he had never been afraid to use them. He now quietly handed a pair to his grandson, with the admonition, "If you ever touch your dirk in a fight, be prepared to use it all the way." He would be placing 81 head of cattle in his grandson's care, perhaps more if things went well before departure. And since it would have been idiotic to trust so much of value to so young a lad, even though he was a husky fellow, well able to care for himself, he was sending along a helper, McNab of Corrie, who with his two dogs had made the trip many times before. They would be 12 days on the trail, uphill and down, and they would expect to deliver to Falkirk Trist a full 81 head, plus such others as they might casually acquire en route. In the meantime, Ninian Gow instructed young Finley as to what he must do when the cattle had been delivered and sold. "You are to leave Falkirk and walk directly to Dunfermline, keeping your money well hidden in your kilt, without mentioning it to anyone. From Dunfermline, head straight to Glenrothes and then to Cooper, from which it will be an easy walk to St. Andrews and the University, where you will inquire for Owen McCrae, with whom you will live, and who will tutor you for entrance to the University. Above all, lad, be prudent, for this is your entry into the world of learning. Make it a good one." That was the miracle of Scotland. From the most impoverished hovels, from the farthest glen, dedicated ministers and schoolteachers identified boys of promise and goaded them into getting an education at the universities in Aberdeen, Glasgow, Edinburgh, and above all, St. Andrews, those centers of learning whose scholars down through the centuries have done so much to alter and improve the English-speaking world. Unable to find employment in Scotland, they emigrated to London and Dublin and New York. They made Canada and Jamaica and Pennsylvania civilized places in which to live. They started colleges in America and universities in Canada. 1,000 enterprises in England would have failed without the assistance of the bright lads from Glenlyon and the Moor of Rannoch and the lone Shielings on Skye. They would govern India and South Africa and New Hampshire, and wherever they went, they would leave schools and hospitals and libraries, for they were the seeds of greatness and of civilization. There was no sensible reason in the world why a grandson of MacNab of Dunessan, drover and cattle thief extraordinary, should aspire to St. Andrews to study Latin, except that for 2,000 years the men who governed the world, making it in each century just a little better, had known Latin. And from the moment Gow had first seen young Finley, he had suspected that here was a lad with the potential to become such an individual. At about this time, various women in the glen remarked that the minister had come to them begging for curious ingredients. He asked for raisins, wanted to know who had currants, was especially eager for some orange peel, and who has such in Glenlyon. He borrowed also, with no promise ever to pay back, spices, flour, suet, 12 eggs, a healthy dram of whiskey, and 2 pounds of butter. When all was assembled, he went to a young widow MacNab, whose husband had recently died fighting the Campbells, and asked her help in sewing a heavy cloth bag. And when this was done, he sought permission to use her kitchen. "But first we must find some treacle, for without treacle it would be nothing." Then he was ready. In my home near the Grampian Hills, we called it a clouty dumplin, a dumplin made within a cloth. And when the ingredients were properly mixed and spiced, he and the widow stuffed them into this cloth, sewed it up, and pitched it into a pot of boiling water, where it seethed for 6 hours, no less. When it was done, heavy as stone, Ninian Gow told her, "My mother boiled me one when I set out for college. It will keep 12 days, maybe 16, and give the parting lad a kiss of love as he eats each morsel." Finley celebrated his 13th birthday at the end of August. Next morning he rose early, eager to head south with his 84 cattle, his grandfather having acquired by usual means 3 additional head. While Rob barked at his heels, his grandmother, with tears in her eyes, gave him his bundle of dried beef, his grandfather handed him a stout walking stave, and Reverend Gow appeared with a heavy gift, which he described as a clouty dumplin. "Eat it sparingly, lad. It should keep you in good health to St. Andrews." And the dominie, a man who always stood at the edge of poverty, offered the only present he could afford— a notebook he had used in his schooling, from which a third of the pages had been torn.
"Keep healthy, lad," his grandmother called, for she might not see her grandson again for a dozen years.
"Keep mindful, son," his grandfather shouted, tapping his own waist where his dirks were kept.
"Keep honest," the minister said.
"Keep to your books," was the dominie's admonition, and the boy was on his way.
His route was eastward down Glenlyon, a marvelously quiet beginning, with hills lining the way. But he was soon joined by a rough skyman coming across the hills from the dark moor of Rannoch to the north. Finlay, afraid there might be trouble, drew close to MacNab of Corry, then said boldly to the skyman, "These are the cattle of MacNab of Dunessan." And when the skyman finally led his cattle off on their own route, he left behind, unknowingly, a fine animal that Finlay had taken under his protection. His herd was now 85. At midpoint in the glen, MacNab of Corry said, "It's best we go boldly over the hills." So they forded the little stream that defined the glen, their cattle lowing in protest, and climbed steeply into what Corry warned was dangerous ground. "This is Campbell country, and when a man droves cattle across such land, he does so at his peril, for Campbells will sweep down at any moment and steal half his herd." This theft and counter-theft among the Highland clans was not judged in the harsh manner it would have been in England, where misappropriation of another man's horse or cow could mean a hanging. Highlanders stole each other's cattle in a kind of game, a test of gallantry and intelligence, with always the chance that one clan might rise up in desperation and launch a general slaughter, not of the other clan's cattle, but of the clan itself. It was heroic competition, and none were more cruel at it than the Campbells, or more sly and self-protective than the MacNabs. There was a saying among the drovers from Skye, "To avoid the MacNabs in Glenlyon takes 20 more miles, but it could save you 20 animals." When the MacNabs dropped down to beautiful Loch Tay, they traveled eastward along its northern shore for many miles, then entered with considerable nervousness the narrow glens leading to Campbell lands. And after they had reached a spot where it was necessary to bring the cattle into an orderly ring for the night's rest, both Finlay and Corry felt uneasy. They slept fitfully while their three dogs watched the cattle. And as they had feared, at dawn a loud, ferocious man challenged them. "This is Campbell land, and who might you be trespassing upon it?" Finlay was about to say proudly that these were cattle of MacNab of Dunessan, but Corry, mindful of the fact that the MacNabs had always sided with the MacDonalds in wars with the Campbells, said deceitfully, "We drove for Menzies of that ilk." "A good man," the Campbell henchman grunted. "But the fee for passing here is two of your beasts." And when Finlay started to protest, he growled, "No beasts, no passage." Corry, sweatingly eager to maintain peace, said quickly, "I'll find you two." But the Campbell said, "I'll do the picking," and he sorted out two of the best. When the huge guardian started to leave with the animals, Finlay was so outraged that he reached for his dirks, and although he was only a lad and pitifully smaller than the Campbell, he would have tried to stab him from behind had not Corry restrained him. "Laddie, sheath your dirks. There's a better way." And the big man departed, not realizing how close he had been to death. The two MacNabs made as if they were leaving the glen. But that night, in the silvery glow that passed for darkness in these high summer latitudes, Corry, Finlay, and the dog Rob circled back to where the Campbell cattle rested. And there, with the subtlest whispers, Corry instructed the boy as to what his dog must do. "Send him to the far end. Tell him to fetch us three, but make no noise." To one not acquainted with the Highland sheepdog, it might seem preposterous to expect Rob to understand such a thieving mission. But the dog was an enthusiastic conspirator, and something of a thief himself. So quietly he ran to the grazing beasts, separated five, then turned two loose when Finley whistled softly in the darkness. Edging the cattle southward to where his master waited, Rob delivered them without a sound to the boy, who swiftly joined them to the McNab herd, and even more swiftly spirited the whole group out of the Campbell domain. When all were safe, Corey, not a demonstrative man, leaped in the air, and in the light of the newly risen moon, grasped Finley's hands and cried, "The Campbells stole two of ours, but we rescued three of theirs." To celebrate, Finley cut open his clootie dumpling, and he had never before tasted anything so good as this grainy mixture of wheat, fruit, spices, and honey. Nor had he ever before feasted with such mixed emotions. To have outsmarted a Campbell, to have watched his dog steal the cattle so skillfully, and now to eat in remembrance of his kind minister and mentor, Ninian Gow. This was a day not to be forgotten, and at its close, when he and Corey spread their tartans on the bare earth, when Rob and his two helping dogs circled the Glenlyon cattle, he somehow passed from boyhood to young manhood. With his claymore at his belt, and his herd now augmented to 86, he felt ready for the great Falkirk tryst. He had become an accomplished drover on the route, and he would become an equally accomplished trader when the throng of English buyers pressed down upon him, seeking to stampede him into an early sale to their advantage, not his. But he could not sleep. This day had been too eventful, especially that dreadful moment when he thought he might have to leap at the Campbell with his dirk. As the August night waned and the stars wheeled overhead, Rob became aware that his master was uneasy. So the dog left the care of the cattle to the other two dogs and came to lie with Finley. And when dawn broke, they were still lying there, both asleep, both exhausted from the previous day's excitements. Why had Falkirk been chosen years ago as the center for this great cattle exchange? No one knew, except that Scottish drovers had learned that this was about as far south as their animals could travel without beginning to lose weight. And the English buyers knew that this was about as far north as they cared to adventure into a land that was, in their opinion, still uncivilized. Falkirk formed a reasonable compromise, and a happy one, for in this year 1805, with peace in the land and the great Scottish rebellions of 1715 and 1745 only memories, a horde of wanderers not directly associated with the cattle trade had pitched their tents along the edges of the cattle field, and here they offered revelry of a wild and often bawdy nature. There were mountebanks from lowland Scotland, magicians from England, actors and singers from Edinburgh, women who cooked warm and delightful dishes, and their husbands or companions who sold tots of whiskey under the trees. It was a traveling carnival, policed by dour watchmen who sprang into action only when some Highlander threatened to cut out the gizzard of the Englishman with whom he had been trading. "Now, now, laddies, stop that foolishness." And often the drover, the Englishman, and the constable, friends again, would repair to one of the trees and get seasonably drunk. Falkirk tryst lasted about 2 weeks, during which the cautious Highlanders tried every trick known to their ancestors, a canny lot to begin with, to lure the Lowlanders into paying a more than favorable price for the cattle, while the Lowlanders hesitated, delayed, and even threatened to leave Falkirk altogether, trying to scare the drovers into sacrificing their beasts at a loss, lest they fail to find a buyer. The two McNabs had improved their chances considerably by the traditional Glenlyon process of stealing unwatched cattle from their neighbors, and now their herd numbered 91. And since every beast added to their original lot had been a choice animal, they now had a rather fine selection to offer, and Finley intended making the most of it. Seven different English buyers had sought to frighten him into disposing of his animals cheaply, and at the close of the second day, Corey warned, "Laddie, "You know we cannot take these beasties home with us." And he replied with a mature wisdom which startled the older man.
"Laddie, you know we cannot take these beasties home with us."
And he replied with a mature wisdom which startled the older man.
"Aye, and these buyers cannot come so far and return home empty-handed."
As Corey watched his young charge, he discovered that the boy had a positive affinity for sharp dealing. He actually enjoyed the danger of holding his cattle back, despite the risk of being left with no buyers. He relished contact with the shrewd English experts, and although he did not himself drink whiskey at the Trees, he found pleasure in joining the men who did. But what surprised Corey most, this young fellow of his stood wide-eyed when the dancing girls with their many petticoats pranced about.
"Come away from there," the caretaker warned. But Finley remained, enchanted by the pirouetting.
Now the tryst became a thrilling test of wills, and on each of those first 7 nights, Finley and Corey sat beside their valuable herd, arguing and eating a little more of that delicious clootie dumpling, until the once plump cloth bag became as wrinkled as a hag. And on the 8th night, when the dumpling disappeared altogether, McNab of Corey said, "Laddie, I think tomorrow we must sell." And at last Finlay agreed. The 7 potential buyers had dwindled to 3, and the one who needed the cattle most noticed that whereas the herd had contained 91 beasts at the start of the tryst, it now numbered 94, and they were choice. Said the would-be buyer to the helper who would drove his purchases south, "I've always liked doing business with McNabs. They care for their cattle."
"And for other people's," his drover said admiringly.
A deal was struck, and with some regret, Finlay watched his precious animals herded south. They had been fine cattle, and on the trail they had behaved themselves and grown plump on the good Highland grasses. But now came the painful moment when the Falkirk tryst drew toward a close. Tents were taken down, and the music stopped. Montebanks joked no more, and the dancing ceased. McNab of Corey showed Finlay how to tie his coins into a corner of his kilt, then said, "I shall take my 2 dogs and move westward toward Argyll, for I have business in Glenorchy. You trend eastward toward St. Andrews, and Rob can fend for himself. He's able." So the older McNab left, with a heavy weight of coins sewn into a corner of his kilt, and his dogs went with him. Now young Finlay was left with a mournful task, which certain drovers had been performing at the closing of the Falkirk tryst for decades. He led Rob to the northern edge of the fairgrounds, and there he tied about his neck a small cloth bag into which had been placed the notation, "This is Rob, belonging to McNab of Dunessan in Glenlyon. Cost of his food guaranteed. Finlay McNab of Glenlyon." When the bag was secured, Finlay felt his throat choking up, so for some moments he looked away. But then he moved close to the faithful dog and talked with him. "Rob, I may never see you again. You were the best, the very best of all." He could speak no more, so he knelt with his dog, embracing him, and finally he patted him lovingly and said, "Rob, go home." Obediently, the red-brown dog left his master and started on the long, long journey back to the head of Glenlyon. He would be 9 days on the trail, and would from time to time come pleadingly to some inn or crofter's cottage where he would be fed, for the note about his neck assured the owner of that place that next year, when the McNab cattle came south to Falkirk, honest pay for the dog's feed would be delivered. Rob had gone about a 1/4 mile on this remarkable journey when he stopped for 1 last look at his young master, and it was only with the sternest discipline that dog and boy refrained from dashing madly toward each other. But the time for parting had come, and each looked with love at the other and went his way.